ever-changing world, Conscious Co-Creation Productions presents a voice of truth and inspiration, resonating a vibration of love and understanding, illuminating new paths for new directions. As we, as one, strive for higher and higher planes of existence, always remembering life changes. This is radio like you have never felt before. Life Changes with Filippo. And now, your host, our MC, the Master of Change, Filippo Voltaggio.
I like that. Thank you, Dorothy. No wonder you wanted to do the intro today. MC, Master of Change, that's clever. Okay. Well, you know, speaking of clever, you know, I don't want to talk too long because we have David Weddle on the show with us today, and this has been such an anticipated show. So many people have been writing in, and what are you going to ask him, and what are you going to say, and ask him to write this for this character on CSI. And for those of you who don't know, he's a writer and a producer for CSI, Star Trek Deep Space Nine. Of course, he's not writing for that anymore, and Battlestar Galactica. He's not writing for that anymore either, but... Anyways, so it's been really exciting around here because David Weddle is going to be on this show. But talking about clever things that people say and people write, I just got an email from a friend of mine who's actually a singer, and you might all know him. It's Alfio, and he's Australian, and he sings all over the world, doing quite well, actually. And he wrote, "Change is sometimes as good as a holiday, but sometimes as unwelcome as a fly in your minestra," which is like a soup. "Dealing with change is the key." So that came to us from Alfio today in the mail, and I just thought I have to share that. But, of course, we're going to be talking to David today about writing and where stories come from and ideas, especially when it's outside of our normal realm of possibilities that us normal people see. And speaking of normal people, actually, last week, as you remember, we had Johnny Seitz on the show. And here's something I forgot to mention. You know, Johnny is considered autistic, as you know, because we talked about it the whole show. But one of the first things he did, besides analyze me, which you all know because we talked about that, one of the first things that he did that we didn't talk about was he started to scribble with both hands at the same time on a piece of paper. And I looked at him and he says, "Can you do that?" And I thought, "Yeah." And then he says, "Now hold this up to a mirror." And I did. And he had written a whole sentence twice backwards with both hands at the same time. I can't even write backwards with one hand, much less two. I thought that was absolutely amazing, and this was something he just grew up with and was able to do. So it's interesting, you know, what people can tap into, and that's one of the things that I can't wait to talk to David about. But during that interview last week with Johnny, he was trying to give an example, and I brought up the analogy of my voice teacher, one of them who couldn't teach me how to sing, but she was a famous singer. The other one who wasn't a famous singer, but was able to teach me how to sing. And the reason was because the first one, she was born with a natural talent to sing and didn't know how to get that sound. It just happened. The second one, my voice coach, and his name was Irv Winward. He taught a lot of the Hollywood celebrities in his day, Natalie Wood and all kinds of people you all would recognize. And he didn't have a naturally beautiful voice. He didn't open up his mouth and a beautiful voice came out. But he wanted to sing so badly, he learned how. And so he was able to teach me how to get my naturally beautiful voice to come out. And so I was fascinated by that. The analogy that we used, rather, for the show was that the same with David, or Johnny, rather. Johnny had to learn how to be normal. So he was able to teach, now he's able to teach normal people how to be more normal, which is kind of a weird thing. So my voice coach, Irv Winward, I would be fascinated by the things he would tell me with a man who was 85 years old when I stopped coaching with him. And the things he would tell me, just, he was in the war, he was a captain, all of these things. But the most interesting things were these things that, you couldn't really put your finger on it. You'd say, well, okay, I understand the war analogies, and I understand, you know, you did this and you did that, but this stuff about aliens and spaceships, did you see them? Were they there? And he'd say, no, but I didn't see them, but I knew they were there. Or I knew they helped me in this situation, which was the most bizarre thing to me, because I wanted the proof. I wanted the scientific proof. And so one day, out of the blue, his wife, Shirley, who would hear me arguing with him, we're supposed to be having a voice lesson, and we're arguing about, are there spaceships out there and ETs and all that? And she came to me and she said, I want to give you something. And she gave me a love letter that she had written to her husband, Irv, many years ago. Because evidently, every night, Irv builds a spaceship. Now, he wouldn't tell me or couldn't tell me whether he thinks he actually does this or whether he's just fantasizing and this is how he lulls himself to sleep or how he spends his time when he can't sleep. He would just smile when I would ask him the question, which makes me believe that he believed that he would somehow be beamed up every night and would build a spaceship. And his wife would hear about it every morning, or and she finally wrote this letter. So I have to read it to you. I asked her permission. This is Shirley Winward, and it's called Love Letter. My beloved builds a spaceship every night, courting sleep by expanding its massive girth mile by mile, adding level after level. The structure spins immensely in its orbit, opposite the Earth. It cannot be seen, and it is here, he goes, each dream time, in full command of his creation. On occasion, he brings me up to date on his celestial agenda. His eyes gleam amber, his glasses fall off his nose, his facial wrinkles deepen to fine earnestness. He permits me to take in how huge this enclosed labyrinthian has become. By now he has forested 12 million acres on one level, filled lakes as deep as Tahoe on another, fetched cloud systems in cycles as natural as our own breathing, set animal genetics in motions on our gargantuan veldt, fashioned self-restoring engines bigger than New York City. On his latest junket, I dare to ask, where are the people? And he says, not answering exactly, this ship will weather 10,000 3 trillion years across the universes through the great buildup of forces that lead to the next Big Bang. And caressing my hand, you and I, at each grand galactic shift, always you and I will be there. We'll come around together. We'll come around again. Shirley Winward to her beloved Irv Winward. And so I wonder, where does this come from? It seems to me beyond imagination. And so I thought that would be the perfect lead-in. I've had this letter for years now, and yet I've never thought about it until now. I thought it would be the perfect lead-in for our next guest, who writes beyond what I feel is our imagination. So I can't wait to talk to a Nebula Award-nominated screenwriter, David Weddle, who is currently a writer and co-executive producer on CSI, as you all know. He served as a writer-producer for all 4 seasons of Battlestar Galactica and has written for such shows as Star Trek, Deep Space Nine, The Twilight Zone, and Kate Shackoff's first series, The Fearing Mind. David is also author of 2 books, the critically acclaimed If They Move, Kill 'Em, The Life and Times of Sam Peckinpah, and the bestseller, Among the Mansions of Eden. He has written for such publications as Rolling Stone, the Los Angeles Times, the Washington Post, the San Francisco Chronicle, Sight and Sound, Film Comment, Variety, San Jose Mercury, the list goes on and on. And just recently, Battlestar Galactica was just named Program of the Year by the Television Critics Association. Actually, that was just a couple weeks ago. So with that, we'd like to welcome on the show David Weddle.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Hi, David. It's great to have you, and thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Did you hear that poem?
I did.
Can you relate in any way to that?
I think that science fiction, science fantasy, and people's imaginations being ignited by all that runs very deep, and I think that it relates to the mythologies and myths and religious stories that we've been telling to each other around campfires since we first stood upright, probably on the savannah of Africa. So I relate to it in that way. I think these are powerful stories, and they're mythic stories, and they don't just talk. They're not just about beings in the outer space. Are really about us, I think. They're really about our struggles to understand who we are, why we're here, what's the meaning of it all, how do we cope with sort of hideous truths about existence that are very hard to cope with. I guess what I'm telling you is I look at that from a Joseph Campbell perspective or Carl Jung's perspective.
The archetypes of these characters that we are living in another way.
Mm-hmm. And I think that they relate to our humanity and aspects of our humanity and our struggle to understand ourselves.
Wow, so sometimes maybe we put these situations into somebody else, something that is outside of us, so we can relook at it.
That's right. To mythic archetypes, yes, absolutely.
Wow, interesting. Well, you certainly make us look at a lot of things with what you write. But let's start since you've gone there. You're a big fan of Westerns.
Yes, I am.
And
because Westerns are also an archetypal form of storytelling, and you know, the Western takes place across vast expanses of land far away from civilization and the infrastructure of civilization, where people are usually on epic journeys, physical epic journeys across vast spaces, but then it often becomes a journey, an inner journey as well, because there's no law enforcement apparatus or court system or edifice of government to tell them what's right and what's wrong. There's no church to tell them what they should or shouldn't believe and what's moral and not moral. And the people, the characters in Westerns are forced to make existential choices about who they are, what they stand for, what their life means, what actions they're going to take to give their life meaning. And really the same is true in the science fiction genre. The two genres have a lot in common, and they have a lot in common with ancient mythic stories of the myths of ancient Greece or Egypt, or they have a lot in common with the Iliad and the Odyssey. Sam Peckinpah said that, who was the last great American Western filmmaker, has a great quote by him where he said, "The facts of the Trojan War don't interest me that much. What Homer makes of it all, though, I find fascinating." So, you know, it's that spinning archetypal myth that is an interpretation of events that Peckinpah found interesting, and that's what you can do in science fiction, and you can also do it in Westerns or in, you know, stories of ancient civilizations or fantasy tales.
You know, it's interesting that you should say that about Sam Peckinpah and focus in on that, because I actually was going to focus in on yet another one of your favorite people, Ken Kesey, and the book Sometimes a Great Nation, right? Or Notion.
Notion.
Rather. And he wrote One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And one thing that I was reading about that was the quote, narrative voice and perspective shifts frequency between time periods and between characters, creating the thematically relevant sense that there is no core truth, only interpretations of events.
Mm-hmm.
So
sometimes a great Notion does that brilliantly. Now, actually, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is an archetypal tale. Both in the movie and especially in the book, McMurphy is in a sense a cowboy hero who strides onto that ward, and the big nurse could be seen as the equivalent of the guy who owns half the town and is being unjust and so on and so forth. It fits very much. Kesey draws on archetypes from Westerns and American frontier stories and injects them all into this mental ward on a hospital. I think a lot of people mistakenly try to interpret that novel as a critique of American mental health systems and a critique of Freud and psychology, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think it's any of those things. I think he's using that microcosm to create a mythic story about the human condition
and very
tell a story about that.
Right.
It's kind of timeless. Well,
there's so many ways we could go with this. There's so many things that you just said what you just said, we could talk for hours on, obviously, if we talk about Campbell's work and how it relates here, we could talk about each of the characters that you put in any of these, or that you develop in any of your shows and just break it down. It could take forever, and I'm sure people would love that. But to keep it a little general here, here are these characters that in the Western did things a certain way, and then is it true when you saw Sam Peckinpah's work, what was that movie?
The Wild Bunch.
The Wild Bunch, right, that you said, oh, wait a minute, that's never been done in a Western. And so what was that, and how did that affect you?
Well, it's not unlike what Ron Moore has done with Battlestar Galactica. You know, any of us who've watched... most of the people listening to this have probably watched hundreds of science fiction movies.
Uh-huh.
Maybe not as many people watch Westerns anymore, but when I was growing up, everyone had seen hundreds of Westerns. And what happens is you become familiar with the archetypes, the types of characters, the gambler, the con man, the gunslinger, the sheriff, the farmer who's just trying to raise a crop, the borderland bad banditos and so on and so forth. And then you go into a saloon and certain kinds of scenes happen in a saloon. There's the dance hall girl. There's a face-off that starts. There's the shootout in the street. All of these things become part of they become archetypal codes that once we've seen a lot of these movies and read a lot of these stories, we all recognize them. Here's the saloon scene. So what Peckinpah did and what Ron Moore did in Battlestar Galactica was to take all those sort of tropes, those familiar set pieces, and rip them apart or turn them inside out, and what you think is going to happen doesn't happen. But then once you've done that and you sort of break apart the cliches, they sort of reach down into the wreckage of that and find the truth beneath the cliches and reclaim the genre. And I give you an example from The Wild Bunch. When I was 13 watching with my dad, that affected me very much, is there's a character called Angels from a Mexican village, and he's trying to convince his band of outlaws that he rides with to get guns for his people because his people are being unjustly oppressed by the federales and the corrupt Mexican authorities. So they finally do this for him. They steal some guns for him that are supposed to go to a warlord, a Mexican general. In one point in the drama, there's a train robbery, and Ernest Borgnine almost falls through the cars, and Angel rescues him. He grabs him and pulls him out from between the train cars, and there's a shot where Ernest Borgnine wants to thank him, but that's not a macho thing to do and doesn't say anything. Well, later in the toward the end of the drama, the Mexican warlord finds out that Angel stole some rifles and gave them to people that the warlord, you know, doesn't want them to have weapons. And he confronts Angel and Ernest Borgnine when they're inside his fortress. It's just the two of them. They're delivering some rifles that they were contracted to steal for this general. And the general says, "What happened to the case of rifles?" And Borgnine says, "Oh, we lost them." And then the general looks right at Angel and says, "He stole them." And so what do you want us to do with them? And Borgnine looks at Angel and then looks at the general and says, "He's a thief. You deal with them." And he rides out of the fort. Now, I, as a kid at 13, like, no hero in a movie does that.
Right.
Rides out on the guy who saved his life and makes no effort to save him and to save his own skin, lies, and runs for it. And so it deconstructs the whole mythology. But what Peckinpah does very intricately is he starts laying on the back of these characters, Ernest Borgnine and William Holden, their failures. They have a code that Holden enunciates, which is not unlike a code you've heard in many Western movies. When you side with a man, you stick with him. If you can't do that, you're some kind of animal. Well, Holden breaks his own code all through the movie. Whenever it's expedient and survive, comes down to saving his own skin, he'll leave anybody behind. He'll betray his best friends. But gradually through the movie, he's forced to face that he's done this over and over and over again. And it comes down to Angel, who's being tortured by Mapache. And the first Holden and then Ernest Borgnine, they can't live with running out on this man. And they go back finally in the end of the movie to reclaim him, and even though it means certain death for all of them. And Peckinpah so meticulously builds it up and so infuses it with the spirit of the times, which was the height of the Vietnam War, that by the end of the movie when they do this and they go out in an apocalyptic battle, suddenly the genre is alive and the core romanticism of the Western genre is reclaimed and it all feels fresh and alive and vital because Peckinpah faced the lies behind it as well. And Ron Moore did that in Battlestar Galactica very much so.
Mm-hmm.
The same, I think, depth and complexity of vision, too.
Very clever. And it adds a whole other dimension to it. And speaking of dimensions, so you said at one point it's no accident that Roddenberry called space the final frontier. Mm-hmm. Now, I thought that was interesting that you would say that, obviously, because there's the great frontier that the Westerns were all about, right? And now we're into the universe and that being a frontier, but it being the final frontier, in your opinion, does that mean this is the last step for our evolution that we have to, you know, conquer this frontier or,
it was no accident that Roddenberry made that comparison. I don't know if I would focus so heavily on final in that, but you take a look at all of human history and then particularly American history and, you know, for most of our whole existence, it's been standing up in the tall grass of the savanna of Africa and going, okay, well, is this all there is? I wonder what's on the other side of that hill. I wonder what's beyond that river. I wonder what, if we could get across that body of water, I wonder what's over there. I bet it's fantastic over there, or I bet there's monsters over there, or I don't know. And so human beings have been driven, it's part of our very DNA, and to go out and see what's on the other side of the mountain. And I remember Ken Kesey talking about this with me. Finally it came to the Vikings, and maybe people before the Vikings, and then the Spanish saying, well, I don't know if the world just drops off on the other side of this water. Well, what if there's something on the other side? Let's go find out. And then the history of America, as soon as we landed on the East Coast, or the South, or, you know, in some cases the West Coast, the very next impulse, but let's just stick with the East Coast for the moment, was to move west. I wonder what's through that forest. I wonder what's on the other side of that river. I wonder if there's a Northwest Passage. I bet there's something even better across that valley.
Right.
And they kept going until they got to the other side, and then there was nowhere else to go. they're standing and they're looking at the, this is actually a very big theme written in Sometimes a Great Notion, and they're standing looking at the Pacific Ocean, and what now? We ran out of places to go. And so then we started looking up. So, I mean, I think it's an inherent drive in human beings, and space, there's nothing left to discover practically. I mean, maybe in a few deep trenches of the ocean we can find, you know, a few mollusks that we've never seen before or whatever. But basically we have explored every nook and cranny of this planet, and yet that hunger to discover, to face the unknown, to explore, I mean, is there. And so space offers the opportunity for that, and then it offers all the opportunities for stories about islands with cyclopses on them, giant squid, sea serpents, islands with a maze with a monster in it, which become planets and asteroids,
right.
And, you know, and magical creatures that we will discover as we go out there, and all that is in all of that appeal to our subconscious is, you know, is there in the idea of space exploration and then tales of outer space. And when we tell tales of outer space now, it's all still possible because we haven't really gotten beyond our own moon. So it's all possible again. Might have been possible for the Vikings when they were staring out across the water, you know.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you were thinking along the same lines as I was with this whole process of each step from being in the grass to now here we are, civilization, looking beyond us. However, I don't know if I was taking a more cynical approach, but I was thinking as far as, again, back to like Westerns and the archetypes of, you know, the good guys and the bad guys. You know, maybe when we were in the grass, the bad guys might have been the animals, and we had to, like, fight off the lions or what have you. And then it was another tribe. And so then, you know, when you said the Europeans came to America, the bad guys were the Indians in their opinion. And that was what the Westerns were all about. Well, now we've created... You know, and then there were the Russians, like, you know, the Rocky thing, the Russians. Well, what's the next thing that Rocky could fight? I mean, an alien, you know, so now we're into the universe. But after we don't want to be fighting Indians anymore, and we don't want to be fighting animals, and we don't want to be fighting Russians. So now we're fighting the aliens. Now, when it's discovered that either aliens are friendly or they don't exist or whatever it is that, you know, ends up happening or they're part of us or what have you, then what is there? And that's where I was getting at the final frontier.
Hmm.
You know, what is there? What would you write then?
I'm not quite clear on your question.
Okay, so when we're done fighting aliens, who can we fight after the aliens?
Well, each other. We've been fighting each other ever since we could pick up a rock.
Well, exactly. But, you know,
we don't need aliens to kill and have aggression. And there's an endless supply of each other to do that with.
Interesting.
And so, I mean, the tales of battles in space are really a reflection of our own love of slaughter, which, in truth, we do. We love to talk. We love it. Our presidents love to talk about how we're a peace-loving nation, and Americans love nothing more than prosperity and peace and democracy. We all nod our heads and we all say, oh, yeah, that's me. Yeah, we love peace, except we've had war, like almost since the beginning of this country. We've had very few years of peace. And we're hardly unique about that in that sense. I mean, all of the Middle East is a festival of killing people that are killing your relatives. And killing people who have a belief system that's almost exactly like yours, except it differs in syntax or a few nouns here and there. But there's nobody you like to kill more than the people that have a belief system that's competitive with yours. So I think that fantasies of war and conflict are a reflection of who we are, too.
So if it became unfashionable or to fight aliens, then we'd be back to...
I don't think it's going. Well, I don't think in terms of tales of outer space, it's going to become unfashionable.
Okay. Well,
it would be pretty to think so. It would be lovely to think at some point it would become unfashionable, but I don't really see that as happening. And I see no sign of it of that on the horizon.
Okay, well, and before I forget here, I was before we moved from the Cowboys and the Aliens thing, I thought it was interesting that there's a movie coming out, Cowboys and Aliens, that Ron Howard is doing, and I thought, who would have been perfect to write about that but you?
So I didn't know that was happening, but that's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the working title, Cowboys and Aliens. I thought, wow, how perfect. This has got David Weddle written all over it.
Well, yeah, well, there they are. They're going right for the mixture of the two archetypal story forms. Yeah.
Exactly.
And it may be on a very kitsch and funny, you know, slapstick level, but it still will be the interfacing of those mythologies.
Right. Well, I don't know. It's Ron Howard, so it'll remain to be seen. And by the way, I have to give a shout out to you by two friends of yours and two friends of mine, Kate Vernon, of course, who played Ellen Tai in Battlestar Galactica. She wanted to be here, thinking that you were going to be here as well, and you thought you were going to be here as well. But obviously, CSI is making you work overtime.
I very much wanted to be there, and I'm very sorry that I couldn't. My hours are. The television business is insane. That's lovely that she was going to come. I just saw her the other day. She's a wonderful, talented actress, a beautiful woman, and both outwardly and inwardly.
We love her too. And Patricia Murray was going to be here, and fans would know her as the makeup artist, the Emmy-nominated makeup artist.
Oh, really? She's in town?
She's in San Diego, but she was going to drive up. But we.
Oh, that's right. She does go to San Diego fairly regularly. That's right.
Yeah, from Vancouver. So,
Patricia worked with me not only on Battlestar Galactica, but on Katie Sackhoff, who played Starbuck, her first series of Fearing Mine, and Patricia was on that show, too.
Oh, I didn't know that.
At Vancouver Film Studios, yes.
That's great. So it would have been like old home week here had that happened. Well, you know what? We'll just have to make it happen another time for another reason. But
okay.
So here we are. I think this is one of the funniest things that you said, that you just fell into writing sci-fi when you are arguably the most prolific and well-known sci-fi writer of our time. So how does this just happen?
No, okay, that's a little overblown, but I appreciate it, but I'm not one of them.
Oh, okay.
I'm a successful science fiction writer. I've made a lot of my career in television has been that, and I was lucky to work on one of the greatest science fiction television shows of all time. I will admit that, but I was only one of many, and much of the credit deserves to go to Ron Moore and David Icke. So.
Very well, and we give them credit absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
But how does it just happen? Oh,
well,
and your writing partner too. Should we mention?
Bradley Thompson, yes.
Right, absolutely.
well, it was a literal connection between Westerns and science fiction. I mean, I had an interest in science fiction as a kid, like any normal kid. I was not a science fiction fanatic like many people that I've worked with on shows. Many writers just devoured every science fiction novel and movie, and I was not that person. I did love Planet of the Apes, both the novel by Pierre Boulle and the movie 2001, of course, I loved. I read all the Jules Verne, H.G. Wells books. Kurt Vonnegut I read a lot of. But I wouldn't call myself as an encyclopedic, expert on science fiction, but I did know Westerns inside now, and I wrote a biography on Sam Peckinpah, and Ira Stephen Bear, who was the executive producer of Star Trek Deep Space Nine, loved my book on Peckinpah, and he invited me to Paramount Studios for lunch to talk about my book, and then he walked me through all the sound stages where they were shooting Deep Space Nine, and being a shameless opportunist, I said, could I try pitching stories to your show? He said, sure. He sent me a whole stack of materials. I'd never watched Star Trek Deep Space Nine. I asked Bradley, who I'd gone to USC with, who I knew was a science fiction fan, much more so than me. He's a very intense science fiction fan, and he knew the Star Trek genre, though he didn't really know Deep Space Nine. We sat down to watch it, and I didn't know what the hell anybody was talking about. I didn't know what a Ferengi was or a Cardassian. I said, what the hell is going on here? And so we had to study it for a couple of months. And then we went in and pitched a story, and we sold a story, and then we sold a couple scripts, and they put us on staff, and then suddenly in the eyes of Hollywood, I'm a science fiction writer. But my familiarity with the Western genre has stood me well throughout my career, because I many times bring up Westerns, classic Westerns, because the storytelling, the kinds of stories they tell, are very analogous to science fiction tales.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I said about you that there's
a... You can use them as an outline or a template to proceed from.
Right. Was it you or somebody said there's a Sam Peckinpah line in every episode that you write?
Every episode of Battlestar Galactica, almost, right. There, almost every one. There might be one or two that we missed, but for the most part, there are Sam Peckinpah references in almost all of them.
Okay,
it's
so...
It's a game among the staff to spot them. And then some of the other writers started doing their own.
So basically, you're just writing Westerns and they're putting them in alien costumes. Is that?
No, I wouldn't go that far.
I'm playing.
Yeah.
Okay. So would you give us a little insight on how does this creative process happen? So What do you do? You're going to write an episode now. At least we're talking about the space stuff. Or actually, it doesn't matter, any of this. What is David Weddle's creative process look like, look and feel like?
Usually the executive producer is your guiding light. In the case of Battlestar Galactica, it was Ron Moore at CSI. It's Carol Mendelson and Naren Shankar. Sometimes the writer has an idea, the individual writer, sometimes the showrunner, they call them the showrunner, the executive producers who run the writing room, will have an idea. The staff sits in a room together, and there may be anywhere from 5 to 10 people. And you have a giant either whiteboard with the grease pencils, or you have big cork boards with index cards. And you begin to bat around the ideas of how this story you want to tell could unfold. And there is always somebody in the room who is designated as running the room. It could be often is one of the executive producers, but sometimes it's a co-executive producer. On Battlestar Galactica was Mark Verheiden, who ran the room when Ron Moore was not there. That person has to make the decisions as the different egotistical writers are loudly arguing their various, I think it should be this way, no, I think it should be that way, I think my idea is better. That person says, okay, I like Bob's idea. Let's do that. Let's open the show this way. And ideally, when it's really working well, it's like a jazz band, as it did on Battlestar. People feed off ideas, and the ideas start to explode, and the cards go up on the board, and it all suddenly starts falling together. You're not even quite sure how it's happening. But that's often preceded by a couple of days of tremendous struggle that's like wading through a waist-deep swamp of stinking mud before you finally break out onto solid ground.
You make it sound so glamorous, David.
Yeah, it's not. And then for me, it's always important to know what's the story. Who is my protagonist? That's who's the story about. What is the emotional journey that character's going on in this episode? And I understand that everything comes into focus better for me. If I don't know that, I'm lost and flailing, and it will not be a good episode.
Well, actually, it's interesting that you should end like that. I was going to ask you, and for yourself, do you have a message that seems to travel through all your work, or that you would like to bring out, or just happens to come out?
Well, I'll leave you with something that Ken Kesey said. I have a big poster on my wall, and it informs all my writing, and it's a good quote for approach to life too, and spiritual issues and the mysteries of existence and so on. Ken Kesey said, don't look for the answer. The answer, I've seen people think they found the answer and then they stop thinking. Look for the mystery. The job is to seek out the mystery, to to plant a garden where strange things blossom. The mystery is much more interesting than the answer. I'm sort of butchering that quote, but that's the basic thought.
Yeah, I got the meaning behind it, and that's interesting because you've certainly given us a lot of mystery to ponder. And during this interview, I was thinking about the poem that I started off with at the beginning and how it could be people like you that have influenced people like my old voice coach to create and fantasize, or maybe that is happening, maybe it's not happening, maybe it's through what you have done and people like you, but in a sense, you are changing the world by doing what you do. You are changing the way we look at the universe, and you are changing the way we look at ourselves by looking outside ourselves. And how does that feel for you? How does it ring?
It feels good.
I see
we have concerts at Bear McCreary, our composer for Battlestar, and people come from all over, and these musical themes relating to various episodes and characters. You see the people grouped around and actually swaying and being, and you can see that they're thinking about a parent that they lost, or a romance that ended and left them shattered, or one of the great, most exalted moments of their life. And you realize that this show is just like a fire that people can gather around and stare into and tell their stories and relate to, and a tribe is formed around that show that we created, and that feels very good.
Wow, David,
I'm proud to have been able to do that play a part in creating something like that.
Well, you're still young, and you've got many years of doing this should you choose to. I know that Hollywood is clamoring to be working with you, and we're happy about that. We've been talking to David Weddle, who at the moment is a writer and co-executive producer on CSI. And we didn't talk much about CSI because we've been talking about how he's changing the way we look at the universe and how he's come to that. But he's also author of the book, If They Move, Kill 'Em. That's a great title. The Life and Times of Sam Peckinpah. So you are fascinating. We could talk to you for hours, but that's as much time as we have at this point. We'd love to have you back at some point with all of our other friends that you know as well, and maybe at a live event. But in the meantime, we've been honored by having you on our show, David.
Thank you, Filippo. I really appreciate the interest.
Okay. We'll talk to you soon, I hope.
Okay. Great.
All right. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Wow. I mean, what can you say? And like I said, we could talk hours about so many of the topics that came up with David. And hopefully one of these days we will. Well, David is certainly a luminary in our times as he writes about things that help us look at ourselves and look at the universe, and is changing the way we do that. And now we have one of our producers. What's your name? Mark Skelton. I'm still in David.
Still out of space.
Yeah, I'm still out of space. I really am.
In a different dimension.
Exactly.
Maybe you're in the Twilight Zone.
I didn't even talk about the Twilight Zone. And I wanted to talk to him about the different dimensions and all that he writes about, in the holograms and all that. But in any event, at the moment we have Mark Skelton and the luminary of today.
Yes. Good evening. Thank you for that introduction, Filippo. Very kind. Today's luminary, his name is Will Allen, and he's a former pro basketball player, that's professional basketball player. And in 1993, he was shocked about the lack of, he actually called it the food desert, because the area where he came from, Park Lawn Housing Project, basically the biggest housing project in Milwaukee, and the whole area was just completely infested with fast food restaurants. And there was no fresh produce in the area. And basically what happened with him, there was only, and the problem was the residents didn't have cars, so they were stuck. So they really didn't have a choice to choose fresh, not even organic, but just fresh produce that they could eat and give their children and feed their families. And so Will Allen had a great idea, and he bought the last remaining farm in the area, renamed it Growing Power, and rejuvenated it as a food advocacy and educational non-profit organization.
Wow.
Dedicated to getting fresh, locally grown food to the local residents. And that was back in 1993. And in the last 16 years, he's just gone from strength to strength. And what I really love about Will Allen's story is that he takes the local residents and he teaches them how to compost, how to grow their own food in their own backyards, how to really become self-sufficient. And that's really my point. That's what I love about Will Allen's story, is that he didn't rely on the government. He didn't rely on grants. He didn't rely on aid coming in. He didn't rely on somebody coming down and the hand of God saving them. He took the matter. He had a problem, and he solved it with his own hands.
In other words, one man can make a difference.
One man can make a difference. It's so true. You should trademark that saying. Copyright. But basically, you can go to his website to find out more about this amazing project, and it is www.growingpower.org. That's O-R-G, growingpower.org. And I really urge you to be inspired, and if you have a similar situation in your area, follow in his footsteps. You know, his name is Will Allen, and really he is an inspiration and a guiding light to everybody. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Mark Skelton, for that. And, of course, thank you, Will Allen, and all the luminaries out there that we are talking about and the ones that we don't get an opportunity to talk about, because thankfully there are so many, and it's growing more and more. At least our awareness of them is, that's for sure. And speaking of luminaries, I consider Dorothy Lee one of our luminaries. She's also a producer. And here with another great message from us, the State of the Universe address.
Hi. Tonight I'm sharing with you a message that came to me in an email a few years ago. I'd like to thank the unknown author for stating absolute truths so simply and succinctly. The title of this essay is, What I Focus On Expands. I focus my energy on what I want, not on what I don't want. Whatever I place my attention on, I energize. Whatever I take my attention away from dissolves. I'm always at choice to where I fix my gaze. If something unwanted gets my attention, I quickly turn away and use my creative energy to focus on what I want instead. Words infused with good feelings and imagery generate the atmosphere in which I live, so I focus on words that increase feelings of well-being. We as a culture have been taught that the way to get what we want is to defeat what we don't want. However, the very thing I oppose is what I attract. So I focus on what I am for, not for what I'm against. Rather than fighting against poverty, I am for prosperity. Instead of guarding against a negative outcome, I am for a positive outcome. If doubt enters my consciousness, I focus on all the reasons I can achieve my desire. As I shift my focus to possibility thinking, any doubt is replaced with a feeling of confidence and an expanded awareness that all is well all the time. Therefore, I use my attention wisely and only focus on what I want. You can find this essay by going to our website, www.lifechangeswithfilippo.com, and click on the Life Changing Media tab in our navigation bar. Please do yourself a favor by printing this essay and display it in a place where you will be reminded of its powerful message. There is much chaos wherever we look these days, so it is more important than ever for us to be centered and grounded in unconditional love and absolute truth. Therefore, it is vital for us to focus on what we want, knowing that whatever we focus on expands because energy flows where our attention goes. So many of my clients have been asking me if pretending that all is good is just another form of denial, and I have to admit that this is a very good question. I truly believe that we are the co-creators of our lives, and I truly do believe and know that what I focus on expands, so the answer is simple. By acknowledging the negative information surrounding us and then putting our attention on the way we would like things to be is what we need to do to become conscious co-creators. To simply say that what appears to be reality, such as the negative aspects of life occurring all over the world, like famine, war, disease, worldwide financial collapse, overdue rent or mortgage payments, overdrawn bank accounts, credit card debt, etc. To say that this is not real is not going to get us to where we want to be. However, if we just acknowledge that the bank account may be overdrawn in this moment and then change our thoughts to how grateful we are that the rent or mortgage payment has been made, the car, cable, phone, gas, water, and electric bills are all current, and that there is good and healthy food in the house, and that there's plenty of gas in the cars, then we step out of the place of negativity into the attitude of gratitude. And this is where we need to be to co-create what we wish to see in the world. Please understand that I am not saying that this is easy to do, but I am saying that this is what we most must do. What is easy for us is to fall into old habits of mind that have been with us for generations. We must focus on the good in order to create more good. I admit that there are many moments, more than I am proud to confess, when I have slipped into the three-dimensional world as if it were ultimate reality. However, I have surrounded myself with my soul family and have enlisted each member to remind me when they see me operating at a less than optimal level of consciousness, and they are happy to do this favor for me. Just yesterday, I was reminded to think before I speak and make sure that I am connected before I answer a question. I had answered a question from a client just off the top of my head because I thought it was a silly question and the answer was not important to me. When the client wrote me the next day and told me that his friend was an expert in the field and was disappointed in my answer, I did what I could have done in the first place. Instead of giving a wrong answer, I could Google the question and answer correctly. And now I know, as much as I can know anything based on research, that stars are simply small suns because they're comprised of the same energies. I'm truly grateful to this client for reminding me to think before I speak and to make sure that I'm giving a correct answer to even the silliest questions. I also learned that what appeared to be silly to me was really important to him, and I apologized for my treatment of the question. Please join me in shifting our focus to possibility thinking and replacing any doubt with a feeling of confidence and truly know that all is well all of the time, no matter what it looks like in the first moment of observation. By choosing to live the truth of this essay every day of our lives, we are choosing to become conscious co-creators. And when we choose to live this profound message by putting it into action in our lives every single day, we can easily co-create the changes in the world we wish to see. By shifting our focus to the things we want instead of focusing on the negative that appears to be truth, we will co-create a world filled with love, peace, and abundance for all. Until next week, please choose to love yourself enough to make very conscious and elegant choices. And please know that you are love, you are lovable, and you are loved.
Thank you, Dorothy Lee. So that's our show. And it's been very exciting. It has gone by so quickly. And it's probably because of what we talk about and how much fun we have talking about it. We have so much fun preparing for it and then so much fun afterwards talking about it. And usually the guest is here and we're taking pictures that you all probably see up on Facebook and we're having fun. And it's just a great time. So with that, what can I say but to thank our guest, David Weddle, producer and writer, for being with us today. I mean, really, he was just amazing, and he's so hard to nail down, and he's so busy, and we are so grateful that he chose to be on our particular show, and that has a lot to do with thanks to our producer Mark Skelton. So we thank him for being on our show, and we invite you to go to the archives if you've missed any part of this or you'd like to hear it again, on our website, and click on the link to hear that show or this show or any other show for that matter that we've done already. So please do that and let us know what you think. And we look forward to being together with you again on our next week when we're with the Green Children. Now that's going to be exciting. The Green Children are a musical group who are so much more, have done so much, And I can't wait to share with you exactly what they've done. They're actually going to be also with us during our live event. So if you go to our website, you will learn about them. And you can also come meet them live if you are local to the Los Angeles area. And someday soon, we'll be able to travel around to possibly where you are. Remember, you can keep the conversation going during the week by visiting us and writing us at our website at www.lifechangeswithfilippo.com. Of course, my name is spelled F-I-L-I-P-P-O. And connect with us on our Life Changes with Filippo Facebook fan page, or for that matter, any of our personal Facebook pages. Today's show has been made possible in part by our sponsors, IonWays Water Systems. Change your water, change your life, and Love and Miracles. To learn more about them, visit our sponsor page on our website and click on their links. I am Filippo Voltaggio, and it has been my pleasure being of service by hosting Life Changes with Filippo today. I, along with our producers, Dorothy Lee, Mark Skelton, Mark Leger, and our engineer, Seth, thank you for joining us today and for joining us in being a part of this show and for being a part of the change we all wish to see in the world. Ciao.
You have been listening to Life Changes with Filippo. Join us here every Monday night at 7 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And visit us on the web at lifechangeswithfilippo.com. That's Filippo, F-I-L-I-P-P-O.com. And follow our community on Facebook at Life Changes with Filippo. Join us here next week as we consciously embrace the only constant, life changes.